Hi, and welcome to the Changing Perspectives Podcast, the show where we discuss a variety of topics including grief, parenting, health and wellness, and relationships. Join us and explore a number of changing perspectives. We're your hosts, Jenny and Josh Brennan. Hi, Jenny.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Episode 13. This is very exciting.
Yes, it's May now.
It's May. Goodness, you're right. May 2019.
Do you know what April showers bring?
May flowers.
Do you know what May flowers bring?
I don't.
Pilgrims.
That's great. I forgot about that. Is that a Jacob joke?
That is a Jacob joke.
That's perfect.
Another Jacob joke is, what do you call a bagel with wings?
What?
A plain bagel.
Plain bagel.
Yep.
Okay. He's going to buy us a house when he's a famous stand-up comedian.
I think so.
I'm pretty sure. Maybe a couple houses.
That'd be nice.
Before we jump into today's topic, I just want to thank everybody. We've got such a great response to the podcast and lots of new listeners all the time. So it's really exciting. I just wanted to invite everyone to like us, review us, follow us, all that stuff. It gives other folks a chance to get exposure to changing perspectives. And yeah, that's it. Share. If you like it, share it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. And also engage with us. So if there are things you want us to talk about or thoughts you have about topics we're talking about, go ahead and share them with us. You can send us a message or post on Instagram or Facebook, wherever you find us.
I think I said it last time. I'll say it again. My most exciting podcast experiences in the past as a fan have to do with the engagement online with the online community. So I hope that Changing Perspectives can have that as well.
Cool.
Yeah. So episode 13, we're back to a myths about episode.
We are myths about. Yeah. So maybe this is the third in our series. Myths about organ and tissue donation, myths about hospice. And now we are doing myths about funeral directors and the funeral industry. Another sort of topic near and dear to my heart. I have lots of topics near and dear to my heart.
Right. That's why we wanted to start a podcast, I think.
Well, we wanted to start a podcast because you wanted to start a podcast.
That's true.
Yes. But part of my experience in working in the hospice field and working in death and dying, and actually I fell into the funeral service field through you, Josh, because you had a coworker who also worked in the funeral industry. So worked in organ and tissue donation and the funeral industry and was teaching and was looking for someone to interview for some college level courses in bereavement and grief for funeral directing students. And, you connected us. And so then I began teaching at the college level for students who were pursuing becoming funeral directors. And I was teaching all their grief and bereavement classes and sort of really learned about the field of funeral directing and really fell in love with the field and feel very kind of emotionally invested in it and emotionally connected to my students and what they represent as a career.
Right.
So wanted to add this to our list of myths about series because I think there's a lot of misconceptions and myths out there about funeral directors and just a lot of general misunderstandings about them.
And you see that exhibit itself when someone has to go through this, right? And when they go and
can you hear have to cat meet purring? She's very happy about this topic.
Oh, you once again, Jenny is joined by many furry babies during this recording of the show. That's Pixie. Yeah. Pixie likes to make her presence known on these episodes.
This is the Pixie podcast.
Well, before I was interrupted by purring.
Sorry.
I just wanted to say a lot of people don't know sort of the basics. They have a lot of assumptions and it affects those first meetings every time, the first time you have to, unfortunately, reach out to and use the services of a funeral home. You're going in sort of blind, right?
Well, you're going in blind and often you're going in with grief brain.
Yes.
Right. We've talked about grief brain a lot on this podcast. And so unless you're doing pre-arrangement, you're going to see a funeral director. You're going into a funeral home to do some planning and arranging pretty immediately after a loved one has died.
Yeah.
And so your brain's not working. You're grieving. You're overwhelmed. If things haven't been planned ahead, if this is a really sudden death and you don't know anything, then you're really completely overwhelmed.
Yeah.
And so, this is a profession that all of us at some point come to need.
Yes.
And they're, it's a profession where they are members of our community. You know, if you're driving around right now and you stop and think about it, whether you're in a big city or a small town, there's a funeral home probably that you know of. You know, it's the funeral home that your family always uses, or the sort of town's funeral home where most of the people are sort of having their services out of. But you probably know of a few funeral homes and some funeral directors. And I want you to kind of think about, what are my preconceived notions about them? What do I really think about? Do I know anything about their training or why they fall into the field? So kind of hold on to that as we talk about this topic today.
Right. And I think that we talked about, during the hospice episode, about the general public oftentimes has this image or this view of doctors, and they're sort of afraid to ask questions and they just assume things. I think that maybe folks often feel the same way about funeral homes and funeral directors.
Sure.
And feel nervous to ask questions, and just especially they're in that grief brain, they're grieving, they're very sad. They're just sort of taking what is being told to them as fact or as the only way. So just a early piece of advice on this, like with anything, just ask questions and be open and honest.
Sure. So we have some myths compiled here. So
yes.
I, as I do, I'm not going to go in order. So I know I gave Josh my notes sheet, uh-oh, but I'm not going to go in order. I'm jumping around.
You are? Well, do you want me to say the myth?
No, I'm going to, because I'm jumping around, so you don't know which myth I want to start with.
So I have no, I'm just as,
yeah,
I'll be as excited and as surprised as the listeners, I guess.
I want to start with this one, and then you can lead after that.
Okay.
But I want to start with the myth that funeral directors are cold and creepy.
Okay. That's a good one.
I think that's probably a really big myth out there, that funeral directors, people that go into the funeral industry, like, must have this sort of morbid infatuation with dead bodies, and they're just creepy and weird. And I remember, was it The Bachelor? I think it was The Bachelor, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I don't think she was The Bachelorette. I think it was one of the women The Bachelor was picking from.
I remember.
I think they called her
I don't know what you're talking about.
The Bachelor is one of those shows that I would watch, and then I would have it on in the background, and Josh would be like, can you not watch this show without me? I kind of want to see what happens. And it has worked the opposite way, like with Game of Thrones and pretty much every other TV show. You've watched it, and then I've kind of fallen into it. Anyways, there was a contestant, a bachelorette, who was on, and they made a big deal over the fact that she was a funeral director. I think she came from a funeral directing family. Mm-hmm. They played creepy music. ABC really leaned into the fact that, like, funeral directors must be creepy and weird.
Right.
They're not.
Well, that's perpetuated by movies and television. I mean, just like that. But the movie that comes to mind for me is Back to the Future 3, where the Undertaker, right? That's not a term that we like to use really these days, but was portrayed as very creepy, walking up to Marty, taking measurements for this casket and everything. But that element, the way that profession is portrayed in movies, it is creepy and cold.
Sure. That's where a lot of these stereotypes get perpetuated by the media, right? So they're not creepy and cold. They are real people who do not have a morbid infatuation with dead bodies.
They don't.
And I've spent lots of time with them. I've spent lots of time with folks who are longstanding professionals within the field of the funeral service industry, and students who are, you know, kind of new. Some of them come from families who have had sort of a history of working in the funeral service industry, but a lot of them also are just students who don't come from a family and really just want to help people.
Right.
Okay. So part of what I did when we were putting this episode together is I reached out to the experts. I reached out to the folks I know in the funeral service industry, folks that are still pursuing their education, folks that own funeral homes, folks that work in funeral homes, people that pursued funeral service education and aren't working in the industry. And I asked them to kind of share, what are some of the myths that you hear about the funeral service industry, and what do you want people to know about your industry? So as we're moving through these myths, I want to kind of sprinkle in some of what they said. So this was one of the big things that they all said, was that there's this myth that they are creepy, that they're morbid, creepy individuals. And here are some direct quotes. Funeral directors are just like normal members of the society.
Yeah.
And that's true. These are people who have children in your children's schools, who may coach, youth sports, who are your neighbors, who are your friends. They are normal members of the community. They vote. They go out for dinner. They go on vacations. They are normal members of the community. Another quote, it can be emotionally taxing to do this job.
Yeah.
And this is so much of what we would talk about in my classes is sort of the importance of self-care, because they are surrounded literally all the time by grief and death. You know, they're really holding, I don't mean physically, they're kind of holding space for grieving families, grieving individuals, and helping them through a really daunting, overwhelming time and seeing a lot of grief. And they're also being present with the dead bodies.
Yeah.
And that can take its toll on them. And if you remember, people die all the time. So they're always working.
Can I ask you a question about that? So the emotionally taxing, we see that the term, the phrase compassion fatigue, right?
Yep.
In a lot of these industries and professions that deal with these tough situations, paramedics, firefighters, police officers, folks that work in healthcare, organ and tissue donation, and funeral service professionals. As someone who worked in, the education, the training program, college program, did you see any, what's the term I'm looking for? Sort of folks that opted out that said, I can't.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also folks, a lot, I think it worked really well that
turnover turnover was what I was looking for.
The turnover. I don't know that I would say turnover. But a lot of people that needed some additional support. And I think this is where it came in handy that I also am a clinician. So not just was I a teacher sort of teaching the subject material, but also had a lot of students at times reach out to me to share that they were kind of going through some of this compassion fatigue, this sort of caregiver burnout, really kind of emotionally stressed, overwhelmed, and not quite sure what to do with that and how to support themselves. So yeah, I saw it even in, I mean, we see that in college students anyways, because it's a lot to kind of be going through. But absolutely. And they would share stories anecdotally, especially the ones that came from they were sort of a legacy student who came from sort of a legacy, a long line of funeral directors, sort of sharing the impact of that, that they saw on the older generations. Did that answer your question? I think
it
I forgot your question.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Some more of what they said about that is, it's all about the family, and they're talking here about the grieving family.
Yeah.
90% is about the living, and only 10% is about the person who died. And here they're talking about the actual funeral. The funeral process itself, the wakes, the funerals, all of that, it's really for the living. It's for the grieving. It's not so much for those who have died. Right. And so think about the fact that there's this one individual, the funeral director and their staff, really managing all of that, kind of holding space for all of this grief, for all of these people. As a funeral service professional, we are more there for the family to help them through the process and to start the grieving process. And think about the fact that I was there, you know, at this college program responsible for the bereavement and grief courses. We've talked a lot on this podcast about professions that work with grief and death and dying. And we've talked about how they don't take any grief courses. They don't take any bereavement courses.
Right.
And here's an industry that requires it. And this is an industry that has a very sort of mandated curriculum, and they all have to then be licensed. They have to take an exam.
Right.
And that grief, the bereavement piece, that's on the exam. They're tested on that. So this is an industry that so understands the importance of the professionals knowing and getting grief and knowing how to provide basic grief counseling and basic grief support and understanding the grief process. It's so important that they test them on it, and they're required to pass that test for their licensing.
I feel like this is true of a lot of these types of professions in these industries, these healthcare end of life industries, or human service industries, where you're wearing multiple hats. But that's very true of the funeral director. You're a chaplain, you're a social worker, you're a family caseworker. It feels like there's a lot going on.
Yeah. You're also a business owner, right? Like these are independent businesses. Although now we're seeing more kind of larger like companies that own multiple sort of like franchises. But you're a business owner. And you're having to sort of coordinate with a lot of other sort of vendors and community providers to, you know, arrange a small funeral or to arrange a large funeral, you know, maybe for a firefighter or a police officer in town,
right,
and coordinating all of that, or a military funeral. There's a lot of coordination that has to go on. So yeah, absolutely, wearing a lot of hats. And some funeral homes also provide bereavement support. You know, they'll do grief groups and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely many, many, many hats, but they're not cold and creepy. And I would say anecdotally, the students that I met are warm and funny and lively and really committed to their field.
Right.
So
very family focused. I mean, the survey had clearly said 90% about the living, only 10% about the decedent. And mm-hmm. the funeral directors that I come in contact with professionally and personally are very, very family focused. The number one goal is to meet the family's needs. I think we talked about that in one of the previous episodes, maybe the organ and tissue episode.
Right. So that was that first myth. Funeral directors are cold and creepy. They're really not. I would encourage you to get to know your local funeral directors. Like buy them a coffee.
You probably stop already in and see do. Them. Just to your point, you probably already do know somebody who works in the funeral industry, a funeral professional, an apprentice or something that you bump into coffee shops or you're at your kids' sports games with. You probably already do.
And I think that there, well, this is us anecdotally. We know quite a few individuals who work in the emergency services field, firefighters, paramedics, mm-hmm. EMTs, who also have a secondary job working with the funeral homes in their town. And that makes perfect sense to me. You know, it's all about kind of helping and being there and being able to be a sort of a source of strength for grieving families.
Right.
So you probably know people that work in the funeral service industry part-time, and you don't even know that they work in the industry because people don't really walk around and share it because there's this myth that that means that they're cold and creepy. They're not. So go ahead and get to know them.
Yeah.
That's my first myth.
Okay.
So you can now guide us through the rest of them.
Can I?
It can be a surprise.
Lead us now? Okay. Yep. Well, let's go ahead and start off with this myth. You must use a funeral home for every death.
Right. So this is going to vary from state to state.
Right.
But in the vast majority of states, you don't have to go through a funeral home. You can do some at-home or sort of independent funerals or not do a funeral at all. So I would encourage you to sort of think about looking into your state's laws around that. And I can put up a link on our show notes so that you know where to go to find that, but you don't actually need to use a funeral home for every death. But why would you?
Well, I think that the answer to that is because they've got this specialized skill set and they're experts and they can take care of it all for you.
Right.
Having to handle this amongst everything else that happens when someone passes away or dies. Sorry. Didn't want to use that colloquial non-grief term there, but let them handle it for you. It's a big task. It's a monumental task. Family has all the decision-making capability, but let them lead it. Let them handle it.
Yeah. One of the actual quotes, from the survey said, quote, "We are people who felt called to help those carry out the final steps in the end of life. If you did not have a funeral director, what would you do with your 97-year-old grandmother's deceased body? Would you carry her to the yard to bury her? Or would you rather have someone arrange all of the legalities of it so you can grieve? Some people are in it for the money, sure, but some people, like myself, are in it because our hearts are in it. We may not be able to make your aunt who passed away 23 days ago look fresh as a daisy, but I know I can find a way to make a person's funeral personalized and memorable and to fit that person's life." So they are specialized.
That's really great.
I really like that quote.
Yeah, me too.
They're really specialized and able to handle these things. You don't know how to necessarily, the general public doesn't always know what to do for body preparation or what the laws are. Your funeral directors, your funeral homes do. Now, I do want to say that in lots of my education, you know, training for funeral service students, they're also required to learn about other cultures. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't just keep it to sort of the sort of primary cultures here in America, but we would really take sort of a global view. And what you find when you really zoom out and look at sort of funeral trends globally is that what we do here in America and in some European countries, this whole act of sort of embalming and right. funerals handled by funeral professionals is quite different than other parts of the world where it is the family that takes care of everything, that does the sort of funeral preparations and
yeah.
handles all of that. And that is important for their grief. So I just want to say that, you know, to this point, this myth that you have to use a funeral home.
Right.
You don't. You do have to follow the law. But there are lots of places in the world that find value in not using a funeral home for the actual, for every sort of aspect of the right. body preparation.
Well, and we don't, again, we're not telling you to do. We're not leaning a certain way in this podcast. We're just presenting information. And if there's right, if your family chooses not to use a funeral home, then that's completely fine. Of course, we want to
just make sure you do it legally.
Right, we support you. I know that in New England, I'm pretty sure Vermont is the only state that doesn't make you use a funeral service. I could be wrong. We can double check on that. But I know that in my work, in my field, families can just take the disposition of the patient's body can go to the care of the family. It doesn't have to go through a funeral in Vermont.
I think in most states.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. That's why I said people can check. I will post the actual laws there because I'm not prepared with what specific states.
We'll look that up.
But thanks for throwing
that. But I know for sure it's Vermont, though.
Do you?
Yeah, I do.
That you, okay.
Yep.
All right. What's our next myth?
Next myth. Embalming is required by law, protects the public, and preserves the body forever.
Right. So three big myths there. Embalming is not actually required. You don't have to choose to embalm the body in most cases. And the reason for it, embalming doesn't actually protect the general public. We don't do it as a right. way to protect the public. And it doesn't preserve the body forever.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can't have a body embalmed and then 3 years later, it's going to look exactly the same.
Back to the protecting the public. In fact, I think the opposite might be true.
It is true.
Because there's some states that if there's a communicable disease, they can't embalm.
Oh, that piece I'm not quite sure.
Right.
But what I was going to say is, I mean, embalming is the use of pretty heavy chemicals. So there's actually right. kind of a risk to funeral service providers and anyone kind of caring for the body in terms of being exposed to those chemicals.
Right.
But we are seeing a lot of changes in sort of the larger funeral industry about people wanting to sort of get back to or lean towards more green burials.
I was just about to ask you if mm-hmm. you could speak to that. I don't know if you have, I have a limited experience with it in my field, but I'm not sure if you have. Can you give us an example? I'm going to dial us back just a little bit. Quick definition on embalming, if you could, on what it actually is.
Well, it's essentially, again, I taught the grief classes, so I never right. taught any of this stuff. But my sort of understanding is that essentially it's removing all of the sort of
bodily
fluids from the body.
And using the vascular system.
Uh-huh. And then really replacing those fluids with
a preservation.
Chemicals. Yeah, like right. preservative chemicals that right. will make the body appear as if it's resting. And will slow down any decomposition
exactly.
processes that are sort of naturally occurring in the body.
I think that's a good definition.
Thanks.
Nice job, right off the cuff.
And then there's a whole sort of restoration sort of process, and the funeral directors go through pretty heavy training in this.
Right.
You know, it would, I would often, you know, in my office space have, heads, like molded heads and things like that of students that were working on right. learning how to sort
that doesn't of, sound creepy at all.
But this is part of their industry. Right. It's part of their craft is sort of learning how to help present a body in a way that's very lifelike. So, you know, if you've gone through this funeral process before, you know, you supply your funeral director with photos of the decedent and that aids them in, their sort of sometimes reconstruction, but, preparing the body for viewing mm-hmm. with hair, makeup, you know, other sort of things that are going to make the body not look like it's decomposing, not look like it's been sort of pumped full of chemicals, right. but that it's in sort of a natural resting state.
And then the other part of my question, you had brought this up, the basics on green burials.
That would be not using any chemicals, really any, only using natural kind of materials.
Right.
You know, as basic as sort of getting a special kind of cloth, I don't want to say bag, but sort of container
yeah.
and disposing of the body like directly in the ground.
No casket. Now,
no casket. Right. But this is where laws come into play because yes. states have different laws around whether or not a vault is required, whether or not a casket is required, whether or yep. not green burials are allowed. So certainly we're not saying like, hey, if someone dies in your house tonight, go ahead and bury them in your backyard as a green burial. Please, you have to check out your state laws. But it's a good thing to do because I think that mm-hmm. most of you driving around out there right now probably have no idea what the laws are in your state around right. funerals and burials. And isn't that a good thing to know so that you can Absolutely. Kind of know what your options are?
Well, that's the other thing I do know about Vermont. I don't know why my thing is with Vermont today, but I'm almost positive they allow green burials.
You know what I know about Vermont?
Nothing. Maple Cheese. Syrup.
Cheese.
Cheese. Oh,
isn't
yeah.
that where Cabot is from?
Cheese and maple syrup.
Mm-hmm. We're moving to Vermont now.
Absolutely. And we can do green burials and we can just take our decedents right out of the hospital.
There you go.
We're going to fact check that. And if Josh is wrong, we're going to let everybody know.
Okay.
Are we moving
did
on?
Did that answer your question about embalming?
Yes.
So essentially, the embalming option allows families to view the body. You know, allows an individual to die. So
can you speak to, just from a clinical therapist perspective, mm-hmm. the importance of that for a grieving family?
So that's interesting because one of the websites that I was looking at in terms of sort of compiling myths about the funeral service industry said that there's no value to a family viewing the body. And I disagree with that pretty strongly.
Yeah.
You know, certainly there are some situations where it's not a possibility for the body to be viewed. Sometimes there are deaths where we don't have the body, or the body can't be reconstructed in a way that, is going to allow for there to be a viewing, or, there's just too much time that has passed to allow for a viewing. You know, maybe someone was missing and was found, you know, many, many weeks later. So sometimes we don't have that option, but it can be really, really helpful for many people to be able to view the body. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in a formal wake, but even at the funeral home, you know, in sort of a space by themselves, because it helps to really solidify for the person that this person has died. And we talked about in one of our previous episodes, and we're talking about sort of grief brain, that so many times your sort of first stage, the sort of first phase that you go through when you're grieving is shock and disbelief. And actually seeing the body, I know it sounds silly, it sounds trite, can help you to really understand that this person is gone.
Right.
So it really kind of helps you to propel through that sort of first phase, first experience of your grief by being able to see the body.
Is the opposite?
And to be able to touch the body,
you know,
to be able to like hold it and sort of say goodbye can be really healing and comforting and important for a lot of people. So there are a lot of professionals in the medical field that will not offer that opportunity to families. And some funeral, I've known some funeral service individuals who don't really think about the importance from a grief standpoint and won't offer viewing to folks, or will tell them that they shouldn't view the body because of the condition of the body. And I've known many people for whom, as the grievers, they really resent that. And that has been a difficult part of their grieving process because they regret not being able to see the body.
Two questions come to mind. Thank
sure.
you. First one is opposite what you said about seeing the body, helping to understand the finality of death. Is the opposite maybe true for children, where maybe they just look like they're sleeping and they can't grasp the fact that they're actually dead?
Well, this is where it becomes important for adults to prepare the child. And if I think if we, was it episode 2
Yeah.
Of the podcast, we talk about preparing children for wakes and funerals.
It seems eons ago.
I know. This is where, why it would become important for the adults to explain to the children that it's going to look like they're just sleeping, but they're not.
Right.
So yeah, it can look that way to children because children are very kind of concrete and literal. So there's a body, its eyes are closed, it's not moving, must be sleeping.
So then it's all about that preparation.
Absolutely. And communication.
So my second question has to do with...
But I would interrupt you and say, but also important for children to see, because what they then can see is that they're not suffering.
The tables have turned. You interrupted me.
Yeah, I'm learning. I learn from the best.
You never do that. You made a good point, though. But the second question I had that came to mind about embalming is, do some funeral homes require embalming in order to view?
That's a great question. I don't know.
Okay.
Thinking about sort of how
there's
quickly.
There's no state law that you can think of.
I honestly, so
it might
I don't
be an individual
know.
Funeral
I can tell
decision.
You all about grief. Maybe we need to have on one of our funeral director friends.
Yeah, we should have done an interview portion for this.
Yeah.
Maybe we have a follow up.
Okay. If anyone's listening up there and you want to be interviewed, and I like five of you come to mind as I know you're going to reach out and say, me, go ahead and reach out. I don't know the legality of it. I can let tell you know. All about the grief and bereavement stuff.
Somebody let us know if, one of the funeral service professionals listening, do you require embalming in order to view?
I'm going to guess probably, like thinking about how quickly the body decomposes.
Just curious, right.
I'm going to think yes.
Okay.
But I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Should we move on?
Yeah, I think that we covered that. So embalming is not always required by law. It doesn't necessarily protect the public, and it does not preserve the body forever.
And it's not the only option.
It is not the only option, correct.
Okay. Okay, myth number whatever we're on. we haven't really been counting this one. But the next myth, cremation reduces the body to ashes.
Right. So ashes to ashes, dust to dust, right? Isn't that... I think when a lot of people hear cremation, they think, okay, it's going to be like tiny little, it's just going to be ash.
Like
it's
going to
be this pretty, like sand. That's what I'm going to get back. If my loved one is cremated and I get the cremains, that's what I'm going to be having. That's not the case. And so I've worked with a lot of grieving people.
And that's an official term. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Cremains, right?
I believe it's an official.
That's what I'm familiar with in my field.
Yeah, the remains of after cremation.
Cremains.
It's not just the body. It's not just the remains of the body. It's also the remains of the casket that is part of the cremation process.
Right.
But not all of the bones get reduced to ashes. So what you get back is you get sort of a mixture of small particles and then like bone fragments. And that can be pretty horrifying to people who aren't expecting it. You know, because we hear ashes, right?
Assume it's just going to be a pile of sand.
Right. Because we refer to it as ashes. So we think like, well, not many people smoke anymore, but like what would be in an ashtray or just sand? And then when families kind of open up and look inside, I've seen them be really horrified that like, what? It didn't work all the way or what? Like, I don't want to be seeing my loved one's bone fragments, but that's what it is. And I think it's really important for people to have an accurate. adequate and accurate. So accurate.
That's a new word. Copyright changing perspective. Trademark. 2019.
a really accurate expectation about what they're going to get, you know, because so many people now are choosing to spread ashes, or sort of break up the ashes so that like the three sisters and two brothers can each have a little bit of the cremains. Or wear them in a necklace or push them into like a ring. There's so many cool things
you
could do, into a sculpture. There's so many really innovative ideas that, folks in the funeral service industry are now choosing to, provide as an option. You can also shoot them into space. Japan is kind of light years ahead of us in terms of cremaine options because they don't have as much space. To store bodies or to store kind of cremains at this time. So now they've come up with a lot of other ideas. So they're sort of, fashion forward, but you could shoot your loved one's cremains into space. You could really pretty much do anything, but you need to understand what you're actually getting back.
Yeah.
That's the process. And while we're talking about the cremation, It can also be really important, just as we talked about the embalming or the viewing of the body being important for people's grieving process. It also can be really important and helpful for folks to actually participate in the cremation process.
I was just about to ask if you could first get, like we did with embalming, a basic definition. Just, we have to assume that maybe someone doesn't understand what cremation is, but, and then you can, yeah, I was just going to ask you to explain that as well.
It's basically the final disposition of the dead body being, fire.
Incinerated.
Yeah, I couldn't think of a crematory, you know, kind of reduced to ashes and bone fragments via intense heat.
Mm-hmm. And it's the body's placed in a casket.
Yep. And then sort of placed, you know, individually into a crematorium. And many places will allow the family, and I encourage the family, to accompany the body to this location and actually like push the button that pushes the casket into that space so that the family is actually the one sort of igniting things. I know that sounds morbid. And at this point, those of you driving are like, I am done with this podcast. This is creepy and morbid. Jenny and Josh are creepy and morbid. This is a reality, right? Like if you're choosing cremation, this is what you're choosing. If you're choosing burial, it's much akin to being there as the casket is lowered into the ground and the family puts the first like handfuls of dirt on the casket.
Well, it's kind of similar to being a pallbearer, like holding the body.
Yes.
Being partly responsible for the disposition and transportation of the decedent.
And if we look at other cultures and if we look around the world, and I know we have a lot of listeners in the UK and Australia.
Which is just so awesome.
And Canada. I know. And Qatar. And new countries every day. So every country is a little bit different. But in many countries in the world, the family, the loved ones really fully accompany the body from the time of death until their final disposition. The body's never alone without family being there. The family is the one that participates in the sort of dressing of the body, the preparation of the body.
Right.
If it's being cremated, the cremation of the body. If it's being buried, the burial of the body. There's also other ways that
we're going to do a cultures whole approach episode on this
final
stuff,
disposition.
Right.
Sure, cultures, and that's going to feel super creepy and morbid for people.
Yeah, we'll disclaimer for that one.
Yeah, but that's and this would always be in that sort of cultural class that I would teach, and I don't teach that anymore because my private practice sort of grew and I took a step back from that. But we would always start the semester and the students would be horrified as we would start sort of looking at other cultures sort of globally. And by the end of the semester, when we kind of circled back around and then looked at our approaches, they had such a greater, deeper understanding of like, okay, this is not creepy and morbid. Why these cultures approach death in this way is really out of an act of love for their loved one. And so I know the first time someone says to you, go ahead and accompany the body to cremation, push the button, be there as that body gets sort of put in the oven, essentially. Yeah. I know that sounds creepy. I know that sounds morbid. I know that sounds horrifying. At the same time, it also allows you to accompany that body to its final disposition. And you know that that is your loved one in the crematorium. And talking to, you went to a training with me.
We did.
With Dr. Alan Wolfelt.
Yes.
It was many years ago. But he runs the Center for Life and Life Loss and Life Transition out of Colorado. And he talked about, do you remember this?
I do.
About how what he was seeing anecdotally in
We saw a video footage of an actual family. Right?
Yes.
Didn't we?
Yes.
Yeah.
He talked about how what he was seeing in his practice as a funeral director was that families were coming to him 6 months after, 6 months or so after a death with the cremains and saying, how do I know this is really my loved one? Like, I'm really stuck because I don't know what happened to my loved one's body after I walked out of the funeral home that day. How do I know that this was really my loved one's ashes and cremains? I wasn't there. And that makes sense to me, you know, because guilt and sort of unease are really common feelings of the grief process. And there's a big question and like, let's sort of name the elephant in the room. I think everyone out there listening and us right now, we can tell stories that we've heard in the news, that we've seen in the news about people that are unethical, you know, people that were funeral directors, but were storing bodies in storage facilities, or that were not cremating the correct bodies, or were losing bodies. I mean, this, you know, no one's perfect. So that stuff does happen. And when we hear one story like that, that calls everything else into question.
Right.
And so here's a way that you can be sure that this is your loved one. Like, think about sort of a traditional kind of, you know, Catholic, Irish Catholic. Those are our roots here in North America, North, New England. You have a wake. You have then the next morning, a little like funeral ceremony at the funeral home. They close the casket one more time. Mm-hmm. The pallbearers accompany that casket. Everybody follows that casket to the church. Pallbearers carry that casket down the aisle of the church. There's a service. You carry that back out. Everyone then follows and accompanies that casket to the cemetery where it's then sort of hoisted over the grave. Mm-hmm. And then everyone sort of does their final ceremony there. And we've sort of moved away as a culture from then sort of having families and friends view the lowering of the casket. But I would argue it's also really important because you're kind of just walking away. So it's okay to ask for those things. It's okay to say, can I be there when the casket is lowered? Can I put some dirt on the casket? Can I be there when the body is cremated? How can I be involved? How can I accompany the body? I know it sounds morbid, but it can really be healing for your grieving process.
Well, it's morbid in relation to, it's relative to America, which we'll talk about more, like as you alluded to, when we do our episode on cultures.
Sure. Yes.
Another question about cremation and embalming. It's not either or, correct?
Correct. Sure. Right. You can do a, and in fact, the funeral that we just went to was an embalmed body who was then cremated.
Embalmed for the viewing and the wake services, and then cremated.
Cremated. And then for a funeral at a later time.
And then I know that there are laws around cremation too. I just wanted to mention there's timing elements required. As far as time, you have to wait from the time of death or day of death until you can cremate somebody. It's 24 hours to 48 hours, and at least throughout New England, I'm sure that's the same for states all throughout the country.
Again, I can't speak specifically to specific laws.
I know, right, and I can't quote them either, but I know that there's a waiting period.
Okay, yeah.
All right. Are we moving on to the next myth?
Yes.
Okay, do you want to, I kind of like the next one as the last one, maybe.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Sure.
How about funeral directors can determine the cause of death?
Yes, I think that oftentimes people confuse, and why wouldn't they? They confuse funeral directors with medical examiners.
Or
coroners, and assume like, oh, the funeral director is going to be.
Which are different things.
They're different things.
By the way.
Yes. Do you want to explain the difference between coroners and medical examiners?
Love to. So medical examiners are medical doctors.
Right. They have a sort of
– they're a forensic pathologist.
They're a licensed sort of medical provider.
Yes. They went through medical school. And depending where you are in the country, you could have a medical examiner system or a coroner system. And a coroner system is almost kind of like a county
appointed
position. It's a political position. Right. They still have a background in medical medicine or whatever, forensic investigation. Maybe they're a former police officer or something like that. But they're different. Coroner and medical examiners are different. Coroners are usually county-based. Medical examiners are also state-based.
Sorry. And a medical examiner would be the individual or the office responsible for determining or attempting to determine a cause of death.
Cause and manner of death. But coroners do that as well, but it's just different.
Okay. Right. But funeral directors do not.
Exactly.
So even though they may be preparing the body in a very sort of scientific, methodical way.
Easy for you to say.
they are not able to determine the cause of death.
Yes.
And I think families just tend to assume that.
Well, I think it probably stems from, I'm just grasping at straws here, but when you first see your loved one's death certificate, it's probably given to you by your funeral director, correct?
I assume so.
I think so. Or they pick it maybe.
I actually don't know.
I'm pretty sure that's how it works. Again, for our funeral service friends out there, let us know. But I'm pretty sure the first time you see that is from your funeral director. So you're actually being, it's the death certificate well, being given to you
by this person. Here's the grief brain kicking in, right? Like yeah. once your loved one dies, and I would say this to my hospice families, you know, once your loved one dies, the funeral home, the funeral director takes over everything. And if they don't do everything, they direct you in terms of who can do things for you. So they become yeah. sort of the leader of everything. So it's easy to assume anything that happens during that time from when like your loved one dies and you say, okay, I want this funeral home to be my provider
yep.
until that body has finally had its final disposition. I'm sure it's easy to assume that anything that happens during that time happens because it is the funeral director doing it.
Right.
Does that make sense? So absolutely. It's just like your grief brain, like, okay, maybe you don't even get the death certificate from the funeral director, but you get it during that period of time when right. the funeral director is kind of running the show. So you would assume it's from the funeral director. I don't want to get sort of mired down into sort of like the nitty gritty because
yeah.
that's not sort of the point of this episode. And it's going to vary from state to state and location yes. to location.
I had something profound. To say. Mm-hmm. I can't remember. I completely just left my brain.
Okay.
Maybe it'll come back to me. I'm sorry.
Okay. That's okay.
Okay. Next myth. Did we cover that myth?
I think so. They don't determine the cause of death.
Oh, this is what I was going to say.
Okay.
So I think that there probably is, at least maybe in the past or currently in very rural areas.
What was that?
Very rural areas.
Rural?
Rural areas. All right. Accurate. That maybe coroners and the funeral director might be the same person.
Oh, probably.
You know what I'm saying?
Maybe. Anyway,
I could just be thinking of TV shows and movies, but
you could be, because now I'm wondering if that would be legal. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, speaking of legal and ethical, funeral directors are unethical. That's our next myth.
Sure. And so this, I think, sort of alludes to what I talked about a moment ago, where we've heard those stories in the news about unethical funeral directors. Do they exist? Absolutely. There's unethical.
There's bad eggs in every profession.
There, yeah, right? One rotten apple spoils the bunch, right?
Sure.
That's a saying, I think.
I think so.
I think it's a saying. But that's true. So I'm not going to sit here and say every funeral director is ethical and moral and perfect. No, there are certainly some that are not and that are in it for the wrong reasons. But the vast majority of them are ethical, are fully yeah. committed to their field, are doing this because they want to help people. They feel really drawn to this profession and their ability to sort of hold space for people that are grieving and also sort of handle the body in a sort of scientific kind of medical way.
And respectful way.
They're right. not going to, you know, be inappropriate with the bodies. They're not going to sell the organs on the black market. They're not going to, you know, incorrectly dispose of your loved one's remains. They're going to do everything by the law. And remember, these are licensed individuals. They have to take right. a licensing exam. They have to be sort of inspected. They're highly regulated.
And because of their training in grief, like you had just talked mm-hmm. to us about, they're very in tune to what the family experiences and sees, right? And so they're going to have this always sense of being respectful and ethical and compassionate for the family through everything, through the preparation,
right.
the placement of the body in the casket for viewing and all of that stuff. It's going to be really just focused on understanding where the family is coming from and how important it is for the family not to see something that is going to be shocking or going to negatively impact them, right?
Yes, and also that they're the ones that step in to respond to anything that comes up that's going to be uncomfortable for families during the ceremonies. Because sometimes there is – well, if we talk about – like I don't have the actual stats in front of me, but if we talk about deaths via homicide – I think the actual statistic is somewhere around 70% of homicides are actually committed by people that, like loved ones,
yeah.
someone that you know. And so in those situations, you know, if you're a funeral director dealing with a death that was the result of a homicide, a murder, then you are probably dealing with mourners who are connected both to the dead person, the person that has died, and also to the person who killed them.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be not just grief in that room, not just shock because it was a murder, but also there's going to be tension and anger because they know the person that did it. Yeah. And maybe they're connected to, maybe they love the person that did it. And so funeral directors also have to be really good and skilled at managing and navigating those tensions and being really
complicated family dynamics.
Really good at doing that. You know, whether that means like separate rooms, separate viewings, but they also have to be really skilled at doing that in a really ethical, gracious manner.
Right. The word that comes to mind for me, is advocate. I feel like funeral directors, are really great family advocates.
That's a really great point. They are. They for sure are.
And
yes.
I think that word can be used in a lot of these end of life specialties, hospice, professionals, organ and tissue donation, you know, the units at the hospital where the patient passed away. A lot of these people become, these professionals become advocates for the family.
They do. Yeah. Also advocates for the decedent. So
yeah.
This isn't specifically on our list here, but what about people that die that don't have family or have done something really bad? Like yeah. I'm thinking about here in Boston, we just last month had the marathon, was the anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings.
Yep. April 15th.
There was real big outrage, and there often is when there's a high profile case like that, one of the bombers died. Well, what happens then to that person's body?
Right.
Right? If they have a family, if they have loved ones, and many would argue, well, just because they were a human, their body needs to be disposed of. There needs to be some sort of final disposition.
Yeah.
Who's going to do that? Well, it's the funeral directors, right? Like at some point, some funeral director has to step up and say, I will handle this high profile case. I know you people think he's a monster, but he has a mother and family and a father, not just the Tsarnaev brother, but there are still people grieving here.
Yeah.
And they deserve an opportunity to have a funeral. I find that ethical. So I find that right. an advocate.
So that tough job falls on the shoulders of the funeral industry professionals
right.
to handle that.
Right. To sort of put their neck out there on the line and yeah. say, we're going to do this. And even though that means that we might get death threats and we might get people say, I'm never going to use your funeral home again for my family right. because you've chosen to perform a funeral for a monster. This is a reality. This happens. The sort of flip side of that too is when we're looking at situations where there's mass casualties. We're looking at something like the shootings in Las Vegas, or we're looking at the nightclub bombing in Orlando, or we're looking at school shootings.
Yeah.
Who's handling all of those funerals? It's your funeral directors,
yeah.
right? It's, you know, we say the same thing, like think about all the first responders and all the folks working in the hospitals and thank you to all of them. But I think we always tend to forget about the funeral directors and the huge role that they play in those situations.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. And the toll
that that can take on them, and how so many of them in situations like that are doing that pro bono. They're not charging, and many funeral directors are not going to be charging anything. But certainly not a lot when we're talking about funerals for babies and children yeah. and situations like a mass casualty like that. But this is where their ethics come in. Of course, they're going to step up in a time like that and provide funeral services that are appropriate and respectful and meaningful for families and for individuals, regardless of the circumstances around their death.
Right. Absolutely. All right. Those were some good points about the ethical nature of funeral directors.
Thanks.
Okay, we're almost towards the end. We got two more myths left, I think. This next one is funeral directors are men.
Yes, it's one of my favorite parts.
Yeah,
because
I'm a big myth.
I'm a woman. So many of my students were women, and so many of them, when we would start the semester and I'd ask them to share their goals, so many of them would say not just that they wanted to be a funeral director and work in the industry, but that they wanted to own their own funeral home. So these are women who want to sort of shatter the mold. You know, when we think about the myths of funeral yeah. homes, we think about like funeral directors only being men. And that's not the case. There are lots of women that are funeral directors, are funeral home owners, and want to pursue that as their career. So this is no longer an industry dominated by men.
Yes, that's a good one.
Thanks.
Okay. And the final myth for today's episode is funeral directors are greedy.
Right. I think that's really right up there with the, like, they're So funeral directors are men who wear fancy suits, are creepy and cold, and like dead bodies, and just want to get rich.
And are unethical.
Right. Let me tell you, this is not an easy job. I've never been a funeral director, but I know lots of them. And it's a 24-hour job.
I was just going to say, you're never off.
You're never
off. Phone rings, and you got to go or send someone to go pick up a
decedent. If someone dies at 2 a.m. at the hospital, they don't wait until 9 a.m. to call the funeral home. You're on all the time.
Yep.
You're constantly planning funerals, preparing bodies, supporting mm-hmm. families. Is there money in this? Yes, there's money in everything. Doctors make money. I make money as a therapist. You make money in the organ and tissue field. Teachers make money. You know, there's very few people that are able to do what they love and do it for free.
It's regardless of whether or not you work in for-profit or non-profit industry, there's reimbursement for services provided.
Right.
Right.
You know, one of the quotes here from the survey said, "We are here to help no matter what. It's not about the money. We are a business. We do have to make money, sad to say it. It costs a lot to come into this world, and it costs just as much to leave it."
I thought that
was interesting. Yeah. You know, like, we don't really complain like, oh, I had to pay so much to have a baby. Like, the hospital made money. The doctors made money. The nurses made money. Yeah, they did, because nothing's really for free in life. And so too do the funeral service professionals also have to charge something. Now, they have to provide price lists. They have to provide the specific costs for everything. And you can shop around. You know, you don't have to go with the one funeral home in your town.
Right.
You could go a few towns over. You could,
funeral directors by law have to provide the price list, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's one that says they're just upcharging to take your money. They don't. They're not allowed to upcharge.
Right, exactly. Right. They have to, at least here in Massachusetts, but I'm sure in many other states, they have to tell you. They can't just say, okay, the funeral, everything's going to be $10,000.
Yeah.
Well, they have to tell you what that $10,000 is covering.
And they have to provide it if you ask.
And someone says, also from the survey, you can bring your own merchandise. If you want a casket from Costco, go ahead and bring that. If you want an urn from Amazon, go for it. So you can really individualize things. You just have to ask. This was probably the one that gave that people, funeral service individuals, really felt the most strongly about in terms of a really common myth. They said, we always hear things like, greedy funeral directors try to get you to spend more money on your loved ones so that they can profit. They're just upcharging to take your money. Every funeral director is greedy. They're only in it for the money. They're crooks. And it's just not true. Are there some for whom that's sure? I'm sure, but there's probably doctors that are the same way, and firefighters, and doctors, and nurses, and teachers, and therapists. It's everybody.
Like I said before, bad eggs in every industry.
Sure, but the vast majority, like, look, if you want to make a lot of money easily, this is not the field to go into.
Nope. It's not easy.
It's not an easy job. I'm sure that there's easier ways for you to make more money. But true, they do get paid, and they do present themselves nicely because they're trying to make your funeral experience classy and respectful.
Right.
And so, yes, of course, they're going to be dressed in nice suits because that's an important way to sort of make things look formal and to show everybody that we've got this for you. And we're taking care of you.
It's respectful.
It's right? that respect.
That a grieving family can see somebody dressed nice in a suit or dress suit or something and understand, okay, this person is going to take care of me and they're professional and know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the vast majority of funeral directors are certainly not greedy at all.
No way.
If anything, they really could benefit from working less. They could benefit from taking more vacations, taking some time off.
I think we should.
Taking care of themselves more.
We should probably do some sort of episode on compassion fatigue, because I think funeral directors take a big hit on that.
Yeah, I think so. Just because of the nature of their job.
Do you want to share a couple of these other statements that funeral directors want you to know?
Yeah, I already incorporated some of them. But then I have two that I want to share. Quite frankly, there are no rules. This is when it comes to funerals. I do not think people should follow the norms and have a $15,000 funeral just because the deceased's friend wanted it. Have the type of service that is meaningful to you, the mourner. So I like that, like encouraging people to really think about making it individual and not doing something just because it was something that your grandmother used to do for all the funerals in her family. Like, it's okay to make things individual. It's okay to say, I don't know that I actually want to, I don't know the value of spending all this money on this one thing that doesn't mean anything to any of us. You can really have a conversation with your funeral director about it. And then this one, everyone from indigent men and women to low-income families to millionaire status, no one is excluded from experiencing loss.
Yeah.
And it's so true that at some point, every one of us is going to experience death in some way and is going to be faced with the possibility of pursuing services from a funeral home. Now is a good time for you to learn about that. Now is a good time for you to figure out the laws in your state, to think about what kind of funeral disposition would you want? Do you want a wake? Do you want a burial? Do you want to be cremated? Do you want to pursue a green burial? Do you want your ashes shot out into space? Do you want to be worn as a necklace by someone? Do you want to be sculpted into a tree? Like, what do you want? Now's a good time to think about that and to have those conversations with your loved ones about what they would want, so that you have the opportunity to make it more individualized. And it's a good opportunity to get to know your funeral directors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Any other questions, Josh?
Well, I just wanted to say, if you could make me into a tree and shoot me into space, I think that's a good idea.
We could do that. We could split up your ashes.
Then I can be Groot.
You could be Groot.
I can be Groot.
I want to be Groot. Okay. All right.
I am Groot. All right. Do you have anything else for us today on this? This is a good one, Jenny.
I think that's it. Yeah. But certainly those of you out there listening.
Funeral service industry justice. And again, please reach out to us and give us your thoughts. Maybe we can do a follow-up and have an interview.
Sure. That'd be great. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that is going to do it for today. Thank you guys so much for listening. You can learn more on this topic by checking out the Center for Loss and Life Transition. Dr. Alan Wolfelt, his website is centerforloss.com. And then Funeral Consumers Alliance, funerals.org. And Jenny will put the links in the show notes.
Absolutely.
All right. Please follow us on Facebook, guys, at Changing Perspectives Podcast. And on Instagram at Changing Perspectives Blog. You can check out our website by going to changingperspectivesblog.com or send us an email to changingpodcast@gmail.com. Go ahead and subscribe to the show so you'll never miss an episode. We will see you next time. Say bye, Jenny.
Bye, Jenny.
We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. My name is Taylor Eland, and I host a show called Just Think, where I look into philosophy, theology, and other scientific ologies to figure out the underlying workings of an argument. If you would like to learn something new every week while getting both sides of a theory, go ahead and check us out on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play Music, and Google Podcasts, along with various other networks, on Sundays.
Hello, listeners. This is Chris from the Super Like Me podcast, a dating podcast, a life podcast, most importantly, a failure podcast. Oh my God, this podcast is all about my dating failures and all the absolute crazy stuff that I've went through in 38 years of my life. You can check me out at anchor.fm/superlikeme. That's anchor.fm/superlikeme, or a simple search on iTunes, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Super Like Me Podcast.
The Changing Perspectives Podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Dizzy Bird Studios, Whitman, Massachusetts. Visit Dizzy Bird Studios on Facebook, facebook.com/DizzyBirdStudios.